It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Wisconsin began the year with record cold temperatures and wrapped up with record warmth. Coming up, we'll look back at the year in weather. First, FOMO is the fear of missing out. But have you ever had FOMA, the fear of missing alcohol? Choosing to be sober can be scary when alcohol is woven into so many aspects of being social, especially here in our home state of Wisconsin. And for some people, it's a way to try to feel less anxious and more outgoing when those things don't come that easily. But have you ever been curious about what life would be like without alcohol or with less of it? Journalist Ruby Warrington is the author of Sober Curious and the woman who coined that term. Ruby, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Judith. Thanks for having me.
Well, Ruby, can we start with you describing briefly your early history with alcohol, or your boostery, as you call it?
Yeah, my booster. We all have a booze story. Booze is so integral to so many of our lives. Often we come into the drinking culture and become drinkers without even really questioning it. And that was certainly my case. I mean, I began drinking, as many of us do, kind of in my mid-teens, at that age when, you know, you start going to parties and talking to boys. And I was kind of shy, and it helped me to not feel so shy and to fit in, I suppose. And then as I kind of go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, then as I sort of moved into my career and journalism, I found that alcohol was a way to help me feel more confident in that area as well, particularly at networking events and when it came to integrating myself in the workplace. I worked in alcoholic environment, and so there was always lots of alcohol on hand.
And but Ruby, I'm actually going to stop you there. Your Skype is cutting in and out, so we're actually going to switch over to your phone. So Rachel is going to give you a quick call. And in the meantime, I'll remind people we're talking with Ruby Warrington about her book. It's called Sober Curious. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you decided to go without drinking alcohol for maybe a period of time or permanently? Did it change the way you socialize and with whom? Or have you decided not to stop drinking because you're worried about how things might change? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. You can tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. And we're going to be talking about Ruby's journey through being sober curious, what she's learned about how alcohol affects us. And we can go back to Ruby right now. Thanks for making the switch.
Thank you for that. Sorry, we were talking about the weather, right? We're having a very rainy day in New York, and sometimes my connection's not so great when that happens.
It's no problem at all. So you, like many young people, had a fair amount of drinking as part of your social life, and you did make some attempts to modify or cut back your drinking, but they weren't particularly successful. What do you think was going on?
Well, I think my drink, it followed a very similar pattern to what I see for many people, actually. Yes, I developed a very kind of habitual drinking patterns. I was by no means drinking all day or drinking when I got up in the morning, but it was very much hardwired into my social life. And the way I was drinking was very normalized, in that everybody I knew was drinking the same amount as me. But there were times when I felt that it would be beneficial to me to cut back, whether that was because I wanted to have more energy. There were periods when I was experiencing anxiety and I felt that actually alcohol was exacerbating that. And I would set rules, you know, I'll only drink on the weekend, or I'll never have more than two drinks in a row, these sorts of things. But invariably, I would always wind up drinking the same as I always had. And I think that's very much just the nature of the beast. Alcohol is an extremely addictive substance. Whether we identify with the kind of problem drinking that we might consider to be alcoholism or alcoholic drinking, any level of regular drinking can become habitual, and it's very hard to break that habit once it's formed.
So you were obviously kind of questioning your use of alcohol because you were kind of trying to set those different parameters that didn't work very well. When did you really start thinking that maybe you wanted to seriously reevaluate the role that alcohol played in your life?
It was after I moved to New York from the UK, and I was going freelance at the time, and really It was quite an unstable time for me, actually. I didn't have a job. I was trying to sort of make my way in a new city, a very expensive city. And I really felt that alcohol wasn't doing me any favors when it came to having the confidence to put myself out there and having the focus and the clarity that I really wanted to apply to my career at the time. And I also was interacting with a whole different social group. In fact, a lot of people who didn't drink as much as my colleagues had in the UK. And so I was being exposed to different ways to socialize and realizing that I didn't actually need alcohol to have a vibrant social life. And the more I began to cut back, and when I say cut back, this time the difference was I wasn't putting any rules. I was just saying, I'm not going to drink and not really putting a time limit on that, and would then go months at a time without alcohol. I began to realize that actually it had been having a huge impact on my overall well-being and that I felt so much better with alcohol. Why would I ever go back to it?
So you coined the term sober curious. It's the title of your book as well. What does that mean? How is that different than the ways that we've maybe thought about drinking or not drinking in the past?
Well, I think up until recently, we've had a very black and white idea about what we would consider problem drinking. There are those people who identify as alcoholics and whose drinking may have got to a level where they've had a horrible rock bottom experience and they found their way to AA or 12-step program. Or we had normal drinkers, and that was really everybody else, wherever you fell on the spectrum of dependence. And so being sober curious means if you're one of those people who is wondering, am I drinking too much? Does this qualify as problem drinking? Should I maybe experiment with periods of not drinking? Then by my definition, you are sober curious. If you're questioning your drinking, then it means for some reason or on some level it's causing a problem in your life. And if that's the case, then I think you owe it to yourself to really answer those questions. So for me, being sober curious, like I said, it means questioning every single impulse or invitation or expectation to drink. And really answering those questions for yourself, honestly.
We got a lot of comments on the Ideas Network Facebook page about the topic. Here are a couple. Marie said, Wisconsin is a tough place to choose not to drink. I find that people assume I have a drinking problem when I tell them I rarely drink. I even stopped being invited to some outings. Sarah said, after having drunk a lot in her early years, has given up drinking. And now she says, I sometimes feel like I need to follow up with, I stopped drinking by choice. And not because I had or have a problem with alcohol, which is nothing to be ashamed of, but I feel like they stop asking questions after that. She says it's really opened my eyes as to how much our society revolves around drinking. And I think both those comments, Ruby, point to some of the things that FOMA is about. The fear of missing alcohol is having to explain or defend yourself and kind of how people are going to change how they relate to you.
Absolutely. Those are very, very common experiences that I've heard throughout the years now that I've been, you know, hosting events and retreats and obviously researching my book and living this myself. And I think that idea, I'm worried that people will think I have a problem, just shows actually how stigmatized alcohol addiction is. When it's very widely recognized now in addiction recovery circles that there are many, many shades of gray when it comes to alcohol addiction, and your drinking doesn't have to have got to that rock bottom level for you to have a problem with drinking. And I think that part of the sober curious movement has really been about helping to destigmatize the conversation about addiction and to recognize that actually we're talking about an extremely addictive substance. And if we do develop an attachment to it at whatever level, there's nothing wrong with us necessarily. It doesn't mean that we're damaged, doesn't mean there's anything to be ashamed of. But again, that we owe it to ourselves to take a step back and to reassess.
Let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234, and Paul in Madison is up. Hi, Paul.
Yes, good afternoon. I hardly agree with the guest and several of the sentiments. As for myself, I came of age here in Wisconsin, here in Madison, at the brief period of time when we had an age 18 drinking age, and I gave up alcohol as a very young man. Be 35 years ago next year. And as the guest said, I had trepidations about my social life without alcohol, but those were pretty quickly relieved, and I saw that I didn't need it. Just did not suit me. I did not drink to make other people interesting, as an author once said. I can't think of their name. And I have the example of some of my peers who continued to drink over the years, and I see the effect on them. Mm. Not all of them, mm-hmm. but some of them.
Thanks for that call, Paul. Ruby, it is that is an interesting idea, and some of the folks on Facebook mentioned this too, that basically when they were not also drinking, the many people drinking around them were not as much fun as they had remembered them.
It is a good point. I think it was Ernest Hemingway who said that. So thanks for sharing that, Paul. But absolutely, and Paul also brought up a really good point that relates to one of those Facebook comments. It's so ingrained in us that we're so indoctrinated to believe that alcohol is an essential part of having a great social life that we just go along with that. And so FOMA can arise when we think, well, if I don't drink, how am I going to connect with people? I won't get invited to parties, or I won't enjoy parties. And it's often not the case at all. It's only when we actually put ourselves out there and have a social life without drinking that we realize it's just an add-on. What's fun and what feels good is connecting with people that we care about. It can, if you've been, you know, if your social life revolves entirely around alcohol, it could be that some of those connections, when you remove the lubricant of alcohol, are not as deep and meaningful as you had felt. And in this case, it can mean, you know, doing some legwork and finding some new friends or new places to hang out. But I guarantee you, particularly with this sober curious movement really gaining in momentum and more people feeling empowered to say, no, you know, I don't feel like drinking, there are more and more meetups, social occasions, events and parties that are catering to non-drinkers.
We're talking right now with journalist Ruby Warrington, the author of the book Sober Curious, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Have you ever gone without drinking alcohol for a period of time? Did it change the way you socialize and with whom? And did you go back to drinking, or did you decide that you liked how that felt? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation after a short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we're picking up our talk with author Ruby Warrington about her book, Sober Curious, and the concept behind it. And let's go back to the phones and go to Sam in Eau Claire. Hi, Sam.
Dad, before before I came around, he was a bit of an alcoholic, and he gave it up through a program that a church was sponsoring, and that sort of replaced his drinking. He became very involved in church, whether it was, you know, leading activities or Bible studies or what have you. And I'm curious what she might have to say about someone who maybe trades alcoholism or an addiction to drinking with something else, maybe another addiction or something positive in their life.
Great. Thanks for that call, Sam. And Ruby, there you talk about how addictive alcohol is, and there are certainly some people who are more prone to addiction than others. Have you found that there are ways to make sure that someone wouldn't just be trading alcohol for something else?
It's very common. When we remove alcohol, it can leave a hole in our life, particularly if we've been spending a lot of time drinking or recovering from drinking. And so, yes, we need to find ways to address what that hole might be. And that can absolutely come from finding new ways to socialize. For a lot of people actually are coming to this sober curious conversation through having got a lot more invested in their wellness. Maybe they've taken up meditation. Maybe they've started going to a yoga studio. And that was certainly my case. I found a very vibrant community around sort of wellness practice, more holistic wellness practices. And I started socializing with these people as well as engaging in the different practices. But yeah, I think it's if you're relying heavily on alcohol, then having some kind of a support group can be really helpful. And in Sober Curious, I definitely recommend, if you're finding it particularly challenging and feel like there is a big hole in your life left behind after removing alcohol, then you have absolutely nothing to lose from finding your local AA group or even Al-Anon group or the 12-step program that's more suited to you. These programs are incredible and offer such great community support as well as a program to help you in a deeper level of recovery.
Thanks for that.
Well, I was just going to say, for lots of people who are sober curious as well, freeing up all of that time can actually be filled with great creative projects. So many people I know are, you know, spending time, launching the blog that they'd always wanted to, or the podcast they'd always thought about doing, or even writing a book. And I think it's just amazing actually to think about all of the extra precious time we can get when we remove this substance from our life.
And thanks for that call. You know, Ruby, one of the things that I found really interesting was that, as you say in the book, a lot of times people drink because they are trying to feel better about some aspects of their life, but actually the alcohol makes it worse instead of better. Here's a little clip from The Simpsons that illustrates that.
To alcohol, the cause of and solution to all of life's problems.
So the cause of and solution to, and it really is easy to get kind of caught up in that way of thinking.
It really is. I mean, if you think about it, when we celebrate, we reach for a drink. And when we commiserate, we reach for a drink. When we're tired, we reach for a drink. When we're happy, we reach for a drink. It's kind of the ever-present substance. And I think that because it is so normalized in our culture to self-medicate with alcohol through those difficult times, what we don't realize is that we're actually adding an incredible toxic load for our body, for our system, and our emotional and mental body to process. So not only do we have the stressors of whatever it is that's causing us anxiety, but then we have all of this, these additional side effects from drinking layered on top. So finding other ways to relax and unwind and actually to cope with stress is really important. Meditation is an amazing, free, very easily accessible tool for that. A lot of people are intimidated by meditation, but there are so many great apps out there now that can help you begin to cultivate a meditation practice. And actually, one of the things that I've discovered that I'm so relieved about is how much more equipped I feel to deal with the stresses of life now that I don't have that toxic load of alcohol in my system as well.
We're talking with Ruby Warrington about her book, Sober Curious. And Ruby, I think some people listening to this conversation might be surprised, but you actually have a chapter in the book Sober Curious titled The Power of Positive Drinking. And can you briefly tell us what that is and why you included it?
Sure. Well, this book is not about judging alcohol as being good or bad. It's not saying that drinking is good or bad. It's not saying that sober is better than drinking. What it's really designed to do is empower people to really feel confident that they're always making the right choice for them when they're engaging with the drinking culture. And I included the chapter on the power of positive drinking to just help people to get deeper into their inquiry. If I am not ready to give up alcohol completely, then when would be an appropriate time for me to engage or for me to try having a drink? And I'll give you an example from my life. I took a short Christmas vacation to Puerto Rico last week, and I haven't had a drink for well over a year. But one night we were there and we were on a rooftop bar of the hotel, and I thought, you know what, I'll try a beer. This feels like it's a holiday, I'll have a beer. But I drank half the beer and it felt so horrible in my system that I had to put the rest down. And that's kind of where I've got to with it now. Alcohol just feels really toxic to me now. Mm. But it's been a slow process of kind of unlearning and actually trying, you know, with a very conscious mindset a few times, what would it actually be like to have a drink? Is it really going to make me feel better, or is that just a fantasy that I'm still buying into? I included it to allow people a little room for error and a little room for experimentation.
Wendy on Facebook said, my husband and I used to sing karaoke at the bar, but have stopped going. We don't miss the noise, the drunks, or the money we spent on alcohol. We will still have a drink occasionally to celebrate, like when we were married in May. But other than that, we simply don't drink. Maybe having a special occasion makes the champagne a little more bubbly. So, you know, Wendy very much in that feeling like she doesn't need to drink anymore, but also leaving the door open for times when she may decide to.
Well, it's interesting, even at the more extreme end, you know, even for people who are in actively doing 12-step recovery, the majority of people will relapse at some point. And again, I just think there's so much sort of shame around that languaging of relapse. for me, I didn't want to hold myself to what I felt was probably an unrealistic standard of never drinking again, particularly as my drinking hadn't got to the, you know, that really dangerous rock bottom level that I mentioned earlier. And it just felt kind to myself to never say never and simultaneously hold myself to the belief that actually my life is better without alcohol.
Well, Ruby, in the last minute we have or so, if some listeners are realizing that they are super curious themselves, what are some concrete tips that you would give them for trying out being sober?
Well, tomorrow is New Year's Eve, obviously one of the biggest drinking evenings of the year. And if you really want to get a full experience of being sober curious, you could commit to a sober New Year. Why not start tomorrow instead of January 1st and actually try for yourself, assume that you're going to have just as much fun and really test it out and prove to yourself that you don't need alcohol to enjoy yourself and connect with your friends. I appreciate that might be a little bit extreme for some people, though. So given that we have January coming up, Dry January is now gaining hugely in popularity every year. And this is an opportunity when you can take a month off drinking. And if anyone does ask you those uncomfortable questions, you can say, I'm doing Dry January. I'm seeing how it goes. But my advice would be to assume you're going to continue beyond January. And during that month, really notice and appreciate all the good feelings that come from not drinking alcohol. Appreciate the great sleep that you get. Appreciate how much more confident you feel. Appreciate not feeling nauseous or having to deal with hangovers. And apply that to your thinking about drinking going forward.
Well, Ruby, thanks so much for joining us today. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Journalist Ruby Warrington is the author of Sober Curious and the woman who coined the term. If you have thoughts about what it is like if you don't drink or you're thinking about not drinking, things that you might be concerned about or encouragement for others, you can keep the conversation going on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, the entire state is expected to get a dose of snow to close out 2019. We'll find out who's going to get what and look back at the year's top weather stories. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, farms around the country are outfitting their calves with Moo Muffs, a fashionable outerwear meant to keep their ears safe from winter temperatures. We'll talk with the Wisconsin farmer who invented them. First, Wisconsin is getting ready for a serious hit of winter before the year comes to a close. A big snowstorm is expected to drop several inches, with the totals getting heavier as you go farther north in the state. It comes a day after some parts of the state were in the mid-50s and getting soaked with rain. Maybe it's a fitting way to end what was kind of a weird year weather-wise here in Wisconsin. Jonathan Erdman is a Milwaukee-based senior digital meteorologist with weather.com and contributor to the Weather Channel podcast. John, good to talk with you again.
Judith, it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, first, let's start with the most immediate weather. What's the situation with this particular storm that's moving across Wisconsin today?
Well, Judith, we currently have an expansive area of low pressure that's spiraling over Lake Superior right now, and that's bringing a lot of snow to at least the northern two-thirds of the state right now, some moderate to heavy snow in some spots. In fact, we already have accumulations of 2 to 4 inches already on the ground in Wausau and in around Eau Claire, and that area of snow will eventually pivot through the rest of Wisconsin the rest of the afternoon into tonight, and we're expecting storm totals anywhere from 5 to 9 inches in northern and central Wisconsin, and generally around 2 to 5 inches in the southern third of the state by tomorrow. Fortunately, we'll be moving out fairly quickly, so this shouldn't be a big problem for New Year's Eve travel or New Year's night travel, but might be some tricky travel tonight into tomorrow morning.
And what kind of snow is this? Is this the really wet, heavy snow, or is this the fluffy stuff?
Well, temperatures are a little warm with this, so this is kind of more on the heavier variety. In fact, some snowfall rates up in northern Wisconsin this afternoon into tonight could be 1 to 3 inches per hour. So we're already seeing reports of snow-covered roadways, including I-39, US-51, in central and northern Wisconsin, and stretches of I-94 northwest of Tomah. So, yeah, this will be kind of a messy travel night tonight into tomorrow morning.
What about winds? Because that can certainly make even smaller amounts of snow a lot more hazardous.
Yeah, that's right, Judith. That's also a concern tonight. We'll probably see north to northwest winds of, gusting 20 to 40 miles per hour at times. So that could produce some areas of reduced visibility. Best if you don't have to travel tonight, don't do so. But fortunately, those winds should start to slacken up pretty quickly by tomorrow. So again, if you're traveling anywhere for New Year's Eve festivities, everything should be much improved. The storm should be gone by then.
So this system has been in the works for a few days now, as they often are before they get to Wisconsin. Where did it come from, and have other states gotten hit even harder than us?
Well, I guess we can count our blessings there. It hit some areas and parts of the Dakotas, Nebraska, and western Minnesota pretty hard. There were blizzard warnings, in recent days in parts of the eastern Dakotas. An area that's pretty susceptible to blizzard conditions with snowfall accumulations well over a foot in some of those areas. So we're getting the winter storm, but we're getting kind of the less severe end of it, if you will. And again, it's going to be a quick mover. So by the time we get to New Year's Eve festivities, it should be out of here.
We're talking with Jonathan Erdman right now. He's a Milwaukee-based senior digital meteorologist with weather.com and a contributor to the Weather Channel podcast. We're talking about the current storm system that's making its way across the state, but also looking back at some of the significant weather over the past year. And parts of Wisconsin actually got a pretty early jump on winter this year. Even some trick-or-treaters had to trudge through a few inches of snow. But for a lot of people, that was the last time we had any significant snowfall. Where are we at this point in the year, and where we would expect to be?
Well, you're right, Judith. This is probably one of the stranger starts to a winter season as far as snowfall that I've seen in Wisconsin. When you have a white Halloween, when you have snow on the ground on Halloween, and you don't have it on Christmas morning, that's certainly pretty strange, right? So, it really got off to an amazing start. Madison, for instance, picked up almost 16 inches of snow from October 28th through November 13th, so that was their snowiest start to a season on record, and it's more than they averaged in through the month of December. So they had a snowier stretch from late October through the first 2 weeks of November than they would typically have in December. So, it's been less snowy in southern Wisconsin since that period. So we're kind of about near average now in the southern third of the state. But it was certainly a record-breaking start to the winter season from around Halloween through the first 2 weeks of November.
Well, and earlier in the year, for the second year in a row, there was a big winter storm in the middle of April. Certainly not unheard of for Wisconsin, but a little unusual. Was that just a coincidence, or is there more of a pattern in the works?
Well, last winter we saw a pretty persistent storm track that took storms basically through the Plain States, through the Northern Plains, and then eventually into here into the Upper Midwest. And that persistent storm track really set up from about mid to late January through all the way through April. So it's not a coincidence. It's just a persistent storm track, and it remains to be seen whether we'll see that the rest of the winter here. But for instance, I mean, one of my favorite statistics from last winter is just in February alone, Eau Claire picked up 53 inches of snow, which is more than their average for the entire year in just one month.
Wow.
And it was their record-shattering month. So it was that persistent storm track, and unfortunately, that held all the way through deep into April.
Well, we also had some really cold temperatures towards the start of 2019. We had that record-breaking polar vortex. Big question, John, can we know at this point if we're going to have another one of those in this winter?
Well, it's too soon to tell that we wouldn't have one sometime, say, in February or even early March. For now, it looks like January may be a little bit less cold than what we saw last January. We don't see any, real teeth-shattering cold outbreaks, at least for the next couple of weeks. And some of our longer-range forecasters at the weather company suggest that may hold through much of January. But as we know, February can be a pretty nasty month here, and there is some indications that February could finally trend colder than average. But at least maybe we can at least get through January without any of those massive cold outbreaks like we saw last year when one location in Wisconsin hit 43 below zero, setting their all-time record last January.
I bet they're hoping to not break that record anytime soon. Well, after winter comes spring, and in the middle of March, there was a bunch of flooding this year, and that has been a recurring theme in Wisconsin throughout the year and throughout the past few years. Farmers in particular having a hard time dealing with all that water. Why was it so wet, and why has flooding become so common?
Well, you're right, Judith, and unfortunately, that's really been the big story in Wisconsin so far this year. We will likely have our wettest year on record for the state of Wisconsin in 2019. And if you look back, we've had now four of the state's five wettest years dating back to 1895 have occurred this decade. So this will probably be the wettest year on record in Wisconsin. 2018 was probably the third wettest, 2016 the fourth wettest, and 2010 the fifth wettest. So the problem is we've just gotten into this stuck pattern where we get heavy snow in the winter, and that adds to precipitation. And then all of a sudden we get a persistent storm track where we get heavy rain in the spring. Then you get the melting snowpack, and that adds water to rivers. Heavy rain in the spring then adds water to rivers. And then we've had periods where we've had heavy summer rain because of this persistent storm track. And then this past year, we've had the wettest fall, in other words, September through November on record, which wreaked more havoc with the harvest season. So unfortunately, that's going to be the story headed into 2020. We're really going to have to watch closely to see if we get another wet spring. I mean, we don't want to pray for a drought, but at this point in time, I wouldn't mind if we had a dry spring and a somewhat drier winter. So we'll keep our fingers crossed there.
So Wisconsin is known for having some pretty severe weather, including tornadoes, as the kind of extreme weather that we have in this part of the country. Looking at 2019 in terms of tornadoes, where did we come out on an average there?
Well, we're pretty close to average. A typical year in Wisconsin, we usually see about two dozen tornadoes statewide. So far, according to the National Weather Service, we've had 28 tornadoes in 2019. Strangely enough, only two of those were in southern Wisconsin. The rest of them were in central and northern Wisconsin. The strongest we had was on September 24th, when we had an EF3 go through the Elk Mound area just southeast of Eau Claire and produce some pretty heavy damage in those areas. So we've been about average. We haven't had any major outbreaks of destructive tornadoes. So it's been a pretty typical year.
You study hurricanes in particular, John, and I want to zoom out on a broader scale. What was 2019 like for hurricane season?
It was pretty active. We had 18 named storms. Six of those were hurricanes. And, in an average year, we have 12 named storms. Six were hurricanes. And, of course, the big hurricane was Hurricane Dorian, which devastated the northwest Bahamas. And then, oh, by the way, it also grazed the southeast U.S. coast and hammered the Outer Banks of North Carolina with some pretty heavy damage in Ocracoke Island. That was the big impact in the U.S. from Dorian, although we had another weak tropical storm produce inundating rain in southeast Texas near Beaumont, Port Arthur, 3 feet of rain or more in some of those areas. It almost was eerily reminiscent of Harvey 2 years ago. So those were the two big impacts in the U.S., both from Dorian and from what was called Tropical Storm Imelda and all those rains in Texas.
So it does seem, at least to a layperson, that storms are getting more and more powerful. There's more destruction, it seems. And the opposite of having too much water as comes in a hurricane in Australia, especially in South Australia, they're having record-breaking high temperatures and fires that come along with it. Those records are being broken. Flooding records are being broken. Is this the new normal, John? Just this really extreme type of weather?
Well, we've had extreme weather as long as there's been weather, but the bottom line is that the climate change is making a contribution. So we think it's making tropical storms and hurricanes move slower. It's making them produce more rainfall than they would otherwise. So it's kind of waiting the dice, if you will, on a certain climate event. Now, you know, a storm would probably happen in minus climate change. A storm would happen, but in this case with hurricanes, they tend to be wetter and move slower. And so there is certainly an imprint that we're seeing in several cases with these extreme weather events around the world.
Well, John, thanks so much for joining us, and happy 2020.
My pleasure. Same to you.
Jonathan Erdman is a Milwaukee-based senior digital meteorologist with weather.com and a contributor to the Weather Channel podcast. We looked back at the top weather stories of 2019, including the storm that's expected to drop several inches of snow over Wisconsin by tomorrow morning. Coming up, we'll hear from a Wisconsin farmer whose invention to keep her dairy calves warm turned into a business that gets orders from around the world. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, we'll hear about how a doctor in Nisida is bringing a new approach to prescribing opioids in her community. First, it's been a mild winter so for much of Wisconsin, but there are plenty of cold days still to come that can be dangerous for farm animals, especially calves, whose ears are at a high risk for frostbite. That's where Moo Muffs come in. As you might guess, they're earmuffs for cows. Besides being practical and fashionable, they're also made right here in Wisconsin. Holly Pode is a farmer from Lone Rock in southwestern Wisconsin who invented Moo Muffs. Since she started using them for her calves, she's gotten orders from other farmers around the country and even around the world. Last month, she talked with WPR host Keely Boltina.
You know, when we're talking about Moo Muffs, I have to say these things are adorable. Did you create them as a fashion statement for your calves?
No, we actually created them to keep them warm, and they quickly become a fashion statement.
Yeah, describe them to us.
Well, they are, they're made of fleece, and then they're lined with a nylon so that they're pretty much water, I don't want to say completely waterproof, but water repellent. So they're good to use then, you know, when it's freezing rain, snow, mix in the snow. And then also, too, a cow tends to, like, lick their calf off a lot. So it's good then when the cow's licking on them, they won't get wet and stay wet.
Interesting. And so I've seen the pictures. I haven't seen them in real life, but I've seen the pictures, and there's, like, a strip around the mouth area, all up the nose, and then there are these two sticky-out ears. And
yep.
They're in a lot of bright colors and things like that, too, right?
Yes. Yep. We actually, when we started making them, it was hard. We just went to, like, a local fabric store to pick up material. And so it was kind of we had all the bright colors because we never knew what colors we were going to have in stock of that nylon. And I guess we would pick the brightest ones so that just in case they were pulled off, like out in the pasture and stuff, you'd be able to find them pretty easy.
Sure. So it works both ways. You can tell if they're on, and also it's
yep.
an easy way to spot them. Okay.
Yep.
Where'd the idea for these Moo Muffs come from?
The calf ear muffs are out on the market. There was not an adjustable pair that were waterproof or water repellent. I actually borrowed a calf warmer box from a neighbor, and he had a pair of just fleece ones in there. And so I was going to try them out on my calf, and they were way too big and kind of all stretched out. So I had my aunt, I asked her if she could make me a pair of them that were a little bit smaller or at least adjustable. And then it was kind of her idea to put the nylon on the outside. She just had some extra material laying around from another project that she had done. So that was kind of where it all started. And then we went from there, and I had enough calves around where I could try them out on my calves and see if they were going to fit, and we made any adjustments from there.
And did you have to make adjustments, or was it?
Yeah, we had to make a few to start with, you know, like, I think, like, the nose band that goes down around their mouth, you know, we made that, we had started out and it was wider, so we made that narrow, and then just the length of the Velcro for adjustments so that they'll fit kind of a wide variety of calf sizes.
Sure, because I assume it's important that they don't rub or cause additional harm when you're trying to protect your livestock.
Right, yeah. We definitely didn't want to cause any harm on the calf. You know, obviously we're trying to keep them warm and comfortable. So, no, we went and, they don't pinch or they don't bind or rub anywhere. And then with the Velcro, you know, it's like everybody's like, oh, can they still eat? They can absolutely still eat. And I've taken videos and put those on our Facebook page because there were people concerned about it. So, they don't even act like they know that they're on. You know, like they're not like trying to rub their head on stuff or get them off. I mean, I put them on when they're, you know, within an hour old. So they really don't even pay any attention to them.
What time of year is important for, you know, protecting the ears? I know that this was something that was actually an issue late spring, early summer even.
Mm-hmm. I honestly, if it's above zero and sunny, you know, it's not that bad. But anytime it gets probably below even 15, if it's snowing and cold and windy, basically any time if you were to walk outside and you feel like you need a pair of gloves on or a hat, they're probably, they would need them then.
It reminds me of when they talk about babies. If you're cold, they're cold, or if you're too warm,
yep,
they're too warm. Same thing with calves?
I mean, pretty much. Granted, they do have hair, and they have hair for a reason, you know, to keep them warm. And their ears are obviously hairy, but it's one thing, too, you know, when they're born, they're wet, and the cows lick them off to dry them, but, you know, they're out in the cold temperatures wet, too. So, you know, that makes it feel even colder for them.
You are not the only farmers using earmuffs for cows, and I understand there's been quite a demand for the products you're making now.
Yep. Yeah, I signed up a couple distributors, one in Japan and one in South Dakota. So I had a couple people from Canada contact me about it too, but they haven't completely signed up to be a distributor. But yeah, we've sold probably about 1,000 pair just since spring. And I mean, really, we would have sold 1,000 pair or better this spring with the cold weather that came through if we would have had them in an inventory, but we were working without an inventory. So as soon as they were made, they were shipped out.
I mean, did this surprise you?
Yeah, that it took off the way it did. We figured we'd sell a handful of pairs. You know, I asked my aunt if she was going to put something on Facebook like in January, and she's like, sure. It takes her about 45 minutes to make a pair, 45 minutes to an hour if she has to cut out the material. And, you know, from there till finished product is about an hour. So, you know, she thought she'd spend maybe a Saturday or Sunday and make some up and we'd send them out. But yeah, it really took off. We ended up having to have a few older ladies come in that were retired that knew how to sew and help us get caught up and put some together.
Right. So it was just going to be, you know, something to do in your free time, and then it exploded.
It was, yeah.
Not so much a free time endeavor anymore.
No. We actually have a company in Milwaukee making them for us now, just so that we could get caught up and have an inventory. We still have material at the shop, and we're still making some because my aunt has an embroidery business too. So kind of when she has a little bit of spare time from that, then she's still sewing some up herself as well.
It's getting colder now, and I have to ask, are you considering branching out, doing earmuffs for other baby animals?
We've been asked that a lot, and we just hadn't had time to, you know, kind of, the pattern will probably realistically stay somewhat the same. What's hard is, though, like, even other, I've had people ask for dogs or for goats or something, but a calf's head is so, they don't change much, even, you know, like, from breed to breed or, you know, most calves, like, the earmuffs we have, they will fit anything except for minis. I mean, the minis are a little bit of a different variety, but realistically, any normal-sized calf, they're going to fit. I have a wide range of calf sizes being born here with different breeds that I have, and I haven't found anything that they don't fit. So the hardest part with other species is, you know, there's just a big variety of a size range, you know. Like, I've even had people ask for horses, and you know, I don't know. It'd be hard, I think, to get it where we could sell like a one-size-fits-all like we do with the calf earmuffs.
Maybe a little less universal when you branch out.
Yeah.
We'll keep an eye on it, though. Holly, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. Thank you.
Holly Pode is a farmer in Lone Rock, Wisconsin, who invented Moo Muffs, their earmuffs, to protect calves during the winter months. She chatted with WPR host Keely Boltina last month about the outerwear that's now selling to farms around the country and the world. And as we prepare to ring in 2020, join us for the Capital Steps New Year's edition of Politics Takes a Holiday, featuring songs from their latest album. That's tomorrow night, Tuesday at 7, right here on the Ideas Network. Well, we're closing in on not only the end of the year, it's also the end of a decade. And tomorrow on Central Time, we're going to take a look back at some of the biggest news stories in Wisconsin from the past 10 years. Those include the election of Scott Walker, the implementation of Act 10, the Sick Temple shooting, the abduction of Jamie Kloss and her self-rescue, the Toma VA scandal and the opioid crisis there and across the state, Wisconsin's role in the 2016 general election, and more, including fun things like the Packers winning the 2011 Super Bowl and a lot of fun with Giannis and the Milwaukee Bucks. We want to hear from you about what stories were significant for you or for your community in the past decade. You can email that to centraltime@wpr.org or tweet us at centraltimewpr, and be sure to tune into the show tomorrow. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll talk with talk about a doctor in Nisita, Wisconsin, who's trying to expand treatment options for opioid addiction and chronic pain in her community. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.